I'm going to introduce our final speaker for the plenary, Stephen Collins. Stephen, otherwise known as Attrib for those of you who are Twitterers, describes himself as founder and chief troublemaker at Acid Labs. Stephen was introduced to me via Kate Carruthers, who you all met, who facilitated the panel session. And it's been great having Kate and Stephen here. They're both friends, I think, and colleagues of Mark Pesce. So it's been very useful for us to have the three of them joining us and speaking with us throughout the event to kind of make some linkages. You'll find a full bio for Stephen in your programs, so in an effort to not waste any more time, I'm going to hand over to Stephen, and he might like to kind of just summarise, add a little bit to what he would like you to know about him before he commences his plenary. I'm just checking that Alex is okay over there. Yeah, right to go. So please take your seats. Enjoy our final session with Stephen. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon. Hopefully you haven't got the post-lunch sleepiness. We live in hope. As Robin said, my name's Steve Collins. I run a little consulting company called Acid Labs. It's essentially about communications. It's helping people communicate within their businesses, out to their clients, out to their stakeholders, out to their customers, about helping them how to identify, solve, and understand the problems that they have communicating and collaborating. I work with organisations from my smallest client this year was 8 people. My biggest client was 3,500. Hopefully I've got something to help you guys. So if we can... So today I want to tell you a story. And like many stories, our hero is a young girl. She's going to face challenges and adversity. But she'll also achieve great things. She might even find herself a humorous sidekick. So who is this girl? What's her journey? She's a girl on the verge of the journey into adulthood, a journey that will take her through high school and perhaps to university or vocational training of some sort. That girl's my daughter, Hannah. She's 11 years old. She's about to finish fifth grade. In 2010, Hannah will enter high school. It will be the 6 years that she spends there that are perhaps the most important years of her time in formal education. They'll establish the foundation of the skills she'll need to carry into further education, into the world of work and beyond, into her career and any additional education she might choose to undertake. As Hannah's parent... He's stuck. As Hannah's parent, as a business person with more than 20 years of work experience and as a potential employer, I'm only too aware of a number of issues surrounding her education and the working world she'll ultimately join that concern me. Not least of those issues is how the education system and governments in Australia at the federal and state level are dealing, or indeed not dealing, with the increasing need for students today to have an education that is connected, an education that focuses on the tectonic shift in the nature of society transformed by the emergence of the World Wide Web, an education that understands that the global economy and work were transformed fundamentally in the late 20th century from an economy of making things to an economy of knowing things. An economy of conversation, of collaboration, and of community. Society is now connected in a way that changes the game. The village is truly global, and even in the third world, hyperconnectedness is making waves. More than this, the classroom and the material taught there is potentially losing relevance as students everywhere, from primary through to postgraduate and vocational education, take control of their own learning experiences, collaborating with each other and in social networks that foster creativity, innovation, big thinking and independence of viewpoint. Educators and education policymakers risk increased marginalisation and further irrelevance if they fail to move quickly, to adapt and adopt to a world that is streaking away from them as they're connected, from primary school students to Indian Ocean fishermen, follow the links and learn from each other in a true global village that empowers and permits them to be as productive and innovative as they can, and forgives or even ignores the notion of being wrong in favour of the idea of failing fast, cheap and often. At Kansas State University, Professor Michael Wesch runs a digital ethnography program that explores the changes being wrought upon our culture by the internet. Let's take a quick look at something he and his students made for us about a year ago.
Yeah, it's good. Probably.
Some interesting thoughts there. The quote from Marshall McLuhan at the start of the video is particularly relevant. So let's look at it. Today's child is bewildered when he enters the 19th century environment that still characterises the educational establishment, where information is scarce but ordered and structured by fragmented, classified patterns, subjects and schedules. That was 1967. That's the year before I was born. So what's going wrong? And what's happening now? When Hannah went into class this morning, the environment she entered was fundamentally little different to that which my grandfather experienced on his first day of school in Wellington nearly 100 years ago, or that of my father in Devonport 60 years ago, or my first day at school in 1974. Chairs, desks, silence. The tools that keep you connected, turned off, or at best scarce. The teacher in front of the class. It was then and is now a largely disjointed, form and function-driven environment where, at best, only the very finest teaching draws a few of the virtually countless contextual threads together. It's an environment designed to produce compliant 19th century factory workers, workers who are part of a model where one held the same job for life, where creative and lateral thinking were discouraged, and where you're expected to simply do and follow orders. But the world doesn't work that way anymore. Today, Hannah's learning environment is the entire world. Arguably, it's larger than that. More specifically, it's this. Hannah's learning environment is the hyper-connected world that she finds herself a part of on a constant basis. She's connected continually to experiences and groups from which she learns and contextualises. Most of those are not mediated in a classroom environment, and many of them are amongst her peers. This will become more so as her ability to socialise and collaborate with her peers increases in complexity and becomes more refined. As a group, they and others like them are entirely collaborative, conversational and community-focused. She's connected into these learning experiences on a constant basis through mobile phones, her iPod, the tools she uses like wikis, blogs, online bookmarking and social networks, and any one of the several net-connected devices she encounters during the course of her day. Often, those experiences are massively parallel. Instant messaging and text while reading or editing something online and listening to something else or conversing with the group in the room. Hannah and her peers are part of an environment beyond the classroom that empowers them and puts them in control. It allows them to follow the white rabbit down the hole of connectedness until their curiosity is sated. This form of learning is also multidirectional. Hannah teaches as much as she learns. The network responds to her as much as it. They are, as Don Tapscott puts it, the net generation. Arguably, her learning experiences in the classroom are becoming progressively more irrelevant as the learning experiences she undertakes beyond the class, deliberately or coincidentally, more directly prepare her and equip her with the skills she will need to successfully tackle the 21st century. She's more connected to, and more contextually so, to what digital ethnographer Kevin Kelly termed the one, than any generation before her. In generations to come, this will seem to be the norm. Right now, it presents an enormous challenge to many educators and education policymakers, as they struggle to keep up with those wacky kids. It's a challenge for which these people seem ill-prepared and ill-equipped. Consequently, we're seeing significant resistance amongst some educators and politicians to the paradigm shift that must take place in order to build the education system that we need. Just this week, we saw further evidence from government and educators of the chasm of misunderstanding of the new paradigm for learning. With new funding approved, the New South Wales government was only too happy to give a laptop to every child in years 7 to 12, taking advantage of the federal government's laughably misnamed education revolution. But what is New South Wales Education Minister Verity Firth crowing about? She's crowing about the fact that these machines will, in effect, be crippled by preventing the students who have them from connecting to their peers and social groups where they do the vast majority of their learning. She took singular delight in noting, "We don't want these kids to be using these computers for the not-so-wholesome things that can be on the net, and they won't be able to, because essentially the whole server is coming through the Department of Education." How wrong Ms Firth is, and how deliciously ill-informed. Of course, this will fail. The blocking systems will be subject to Gilmore's Law within days, if not hours. The kids will figure out a way to route around the damage so that they remain connected. And what about when they're in cafes, or at home, or public institutions beyond school walls? And people like me, we'll encourage and help the kids break the security. Why? Because it's when we're connected to each other that we are at our best as a species. When we're engaged in a conversation with our communities, our collaborators, that we are most able to actively seed fertile minds, to reach into the hidden spaces and draw forth the intangible and form it like clay into ideas and innovations and the next big thing. So let's look to our young hero, Hannah, again. Hannah began using the internet at 2 years of age. She's had her own email address, unchecked by me or her mum, since she was eight. She has administrative-level access to the network at home and an unfiltered connection to the internet. And she knows how to use all of them. Contrary to the rantings of Stephen Conroy, of the views of moral stormtroopers like Clive Hamilton, Vice-Chancellor of Charles Sturt University, or of Minister Firth, Hannah has never encountered any of this not-so-wholesome content on the internet. She has never downloaded a virus, encountered an unwanted person, viewed porn inadvertently or deliberately. Yet she uses the internet every day. So by the estimation of some, she should be repeatedly traumatised by inappropriate material, be stalked by a veritable crowd of unsuitable individuals, and be someone who's incapable of coherent thought, of spelling or stringing a sentence together, and of engaging with others in face-to-face situations. Of course, this is demonstrably not the case. Hannah's an engaging young person, able to hold her own in conversation with adults and her peers alike. She speaks, spells and writes, and does math above her grade level. She enjoys socialising online and off. Her ability to do most of these things has less to do with her classroom, although many of the fundamentals were taught there, and more to do with her natural affinity, like many people of her generation, to engage with each other in a more human, more village-centric style of conversation, collaboration and community. Of course, this engagement is mediated by a different toolset than it was before the Industrial Revolution, when humans last really engaged this way. Back then, it was the Mead Hall or the Village Green. Now, it's a much larger place, the internet. It's my view that, generally speaking, the education system is falling behind in terms of providing learners of any age with the type of education that they need. And I'd like to look specifically at a number of the issues I believe need resolution. Connected and unfiltered. From the time the World Wide Web became a public reality rather than a cool toy of the military research establishment, education has become progressively more connected. Yes, our schools are largely online, but the interpretation of online used in education is pretty much a joke. When our kids walk into class, what do? We tell them to disconnect. We make them turn off their mobile phones and give them limited access to a network that's so tightly filtered it verges on censorship. We force them into a structure that no longer reflects the way society operates. This approach fails to use the way students learn today to enhance the learning process. Rather, it disconnects and decontextualises the experience. We take away that which defines our students and the way they live, their hyperconnectedness. Legitimate resources are blocked because they contain words referring to genitalia, or are blocked because they fail to pass someone's appropriateness filter. What if I want to study the ethnography of white supremacists? What if I need to research sexual health issues? Educators often seem to find themselves behind the eight ball. It appears that there is a serious lack of the right sort of teacher training in using online resources. I don't believe this is deliberate, more a matter of knowledge, time and understanding. But it is an issue of note. It's often the case that the kids are ahead of the teachers in their skill level at finding and exploiting online resources. This was driven home to me this year when it was made apparent at parent-teacher interviews by Hannah's teacher that she was far and away amongst the most online and tech-savvy kids in the school. None of those skills were learned in class. Use of online resources is limited by computer availability. Students are afforded time online or even just on a computer in a strictly limited way. In the worst of cases, there are too few computers in a school for there to be several in every class. This execrable situation is arguably the stuff that should be solved by the federal government's education revolution. Only, with approaches like those of Stephen Conroy and Verity Firth, it doesn't look too revolutionary to me. It's barely evolutionary. Putting this into perspective for Hannah, she and her peers are being denied frequent enough access to what may be the most revolutionary, most paradigm-shifting cultural change in human history, hyperconnectedness. Without adequate access to online information and connectedness between individuals and groups, they risk emerging into the workforce lacking core skills in discovering and consuming knowledge, in collaboration, and in wide-ranging critical thinking. Contextual. In a world where knowledge is the stuff of most jobs, including jobs like artist, farmer, fisherman and coal miner, the ability to rapidly contextualise and draw wide-ranging conclusions about information is critical. We need to see the big picture. We must be willing to be and accept others like Alice, insatiably curious followers of the white rabbit down the hole. For it is down the rabbit hole where the bigger picture that will really build our understanding of problems lies. It is there, metaphorically speaking, amongst the talking flowers, the Cheshire Cat and all the madness of the Tea Party and the Queen, that the exploratory learners will see the bigger picture and draw in the diverse threads that let them discover the next big idea. Knowledge networkers in today's world need to be fuzzy and T-shaped. That is, having a core of strong, deep skills, but having a wide-ranging and insatiable thirst for more information, wider-ranging skills and more context and meaning for what they do. These skills, fundamental to the new economy of the 21st century, aren't being taught enough. Granted, the question of how to make a fuzzy person is a tricky one at best, but immersive, contextual, connected education is a starting point for making it happen. I want Hannah to be as fuzzy and T-shaped as she can be. I want her to be able to look at a problem and see the 10 other problems that define it, to try things just so she can get what a problem or person is about, for her to be able to gather the threads together in a storm of fuzzy, apparently illogical thinking to solve problems in an innovative and creative way, unfettered by thinking either inside or outside of any theoretical box. In fact, she should throw away the box entirely as step one. Engaging. The classroom, tutorial or lecture theatre is still largely run on an industrial age model where learners are taught to behave like factory automatons. The classroom environment makes them ready for a job on the production line or in a faceless cube farm. It's anti-creative and busy work focused and not at all designed to equip our children for a world where bursty thinking, creative knowledge work is ever increasingly the norm. Take a look at Sir Ken Robinson's talk from TED 2006 if you're not convinced. A parallel issue with classroom engagement is that of kids who are unsuited for one reason or another to structured classroom learning. My friend Harriet's son is gifted. Not dramatically different from other kids, he's able to attend a normal school, has friends, engages people quite normally most of the time, yet in a blog post she wrote responding to an early version of the thoughts in this talk, she describes a child nearly destroyed by an education system that fails to engage him or engage with him. The imagination which creates such complex images, stories, songs and machines is becoming a problem. If you can't fill in worksheets, then you can't be intelligent. As a result, the small, sparkly boy escapes to more interesting places in his imagination. He is officially becoming a problem. Parents informed that sparkly boy is eligible for gifted education. But there's a small problem. Disorganisation. It is apparently impossible to be intelligent without being super organised, being able to multitask, multi-track and reference officially. By learning to build bridges, he is able to use his intelligence and skills to connect to people. The world is once again an intriguing and fascinating place. He has confidence in his ability to make a difference. He feels his own place in the world and works collaboratively on issues which he feels are important to his world and himself. His adventures and his risks are real, exciting and relate to the future he is constructing himself. The link to this blog post is in my blog, where all the references here are linked. It is worth reading. But it's not just our kids, it's us too. I began and abandoned master's studies this year because the classes failed to engage me adequately. By being connected and engaged beyond the formal frame of the course, I already had more information of more relevance and more currency, direct from world-recognised subject experts, available to me than that which was being presented in class. And when I attempted to introduce it, introduce the leading thinkers and their work to the class, I was met with stunned silence or an "I don't quite get it" response. I'm not the only one. I know several people for whom the formal education process, either at school or in tertiary study, simply wasn't viable. They are or were too curious, too well-read, unstructured in their thinking, unable to complete written tests, disorganised in classroom situations, too fuzzy. At least one of those people is now an internationally known academic in his field at this university. To quote another of my colleagues, Nathaniel, who is one of the smartest web development minds that I know, "I did year 8 to 11. I was homeschooled for the first 7 years. I was mostly self-taught, microbiology, quantum mechanics, and lots more. My 4 years at school and college made me dumber, stunted my creative growth, and blunted my potential." So, once more to Hannah. What does engaging mean for her? I can't think of the number of afternoons I've asked, "Tell me about school today," only to be answered with "normal" or a low-detailed description of a few activities. Yet there are also times when I get a detailed blow-by-blow description of everything. That should be the norm. Education needs to be exciting and relevant to each and every student. In the collaborative, hyper-connected world, everything is relevant because everything encountered and learned from is a deliberate choice. Dynamic, diverse and passionate. Literacy and numeracy are unarguably critical components in a well-rounded education, but it's not enough for several reasons. The target shouldn't be functional literacy and numeracy. It should be deep, contextualised expertise. As well, the notion of creative and arts subjects as lesser to literacy and numeracy is madness. In all schools, the aim should be to produce graduating students that are not only appropriately educated in many subjects, but to do so in such a way as the students are invigorated and excited by the things that they are taught, and taught in such a way that during and after school, they remain insatiably curious about their worlds and what their place in it could mean. We need more Leonardos, more Isaac Newtons, more Jared Diamonds. We need to graduate more people like polymath Ben Dunlap, president of Wofford College in the US. Ben is a man so passionate about the diversity of the experience he has learned from that you can't help by being inspired by him. His talk at TED 2007 is truly incredible and something that all educators should watch. It's no longer enough to graduate people from education at any level who just get through. The world today, even in business as usual, needs more passionate, driven, widely experienced, contextualised lifelong learners to drive the agenda, politically, socially and creatively. Hannah's interests are diverse. Like many 11-year-olds, she's a fan of the Veronicas, loves cats and dresses like her friends. But she's also an emerging explorer. I see in her a growing curiosity about the world, and I actively encourage her to follow the white rabbit wherever it may lead her. Collaborative on as many levels as possible. The notion of truly collaborative learning, between students, between teachers and students, between classrooms, between different schools, between different countries, began to emerge when I was at school. We had the concepts, we had the ideas, but the technology was a massive hurdle. Now, the technology has caught up and exceeded those ideas. A massively collaborative, constantly hyper-connected education is a practical and technical reality. So why isn't education like this completely pervasive? Why are we still mostly stuck in the classroom? Why is the entire experience not multifaceted, collaborative, a global village of contextualised learning within individual institutions and across any grouping that might be worthwhile? It's things like online gaming, for example, that is teaching us leadership and team building skills. It's editing pages on something like Wikipedia that help us learn to reach consensus. It's the always-on network of text messages, email, social networks, Twitter messages that help us build a village where everyone is our immediate neighbour. The power to collaborate easily with anyone and to make it a viable and valuable cultural and learning experience is here, now. For Hannah, this world just is. For the rest of us, it's sink or swim. Too many of us, too comfortable with a world where hyperconnectedness didn't exist, seem to be choosing the sink option, or we're trying to ignore a problem we hope will go away. It's too late. Society has connected and changed already. It's time to join in. My final thought is that education needs to be targeted at producing graduates equipped for 21st century society. In Australia and many other places, there's a massive skills shortage across many industries. It's arguable our schools, from primary schools to universities, are not adequately equipped or considering the needs of society in preparing graduates for work and worthwhile functional participation. Issues such as the shift to knowledge work, the need for creativity and innovation, the apparent schisms between older and younger generations of workers are all issues that I feel sometimes are inadequately dealt with. As a potential employer, and as more importantly as a human, I'm less interested in whether someone has formal training in a particular field than if they are engaged and engaging, a big thinker, excited about their world, insatiably curious, and prepared to jump in and try something new. It is far better to fail and learn from the experience than not try and play it safe. In today's world, willingness to take a risk in the name of learning and broadening experience is a key factor in building successful lives and businesses. Too many rest on their past successes and hope that this will maintain them. Meantime, the hyper-connected continue to pull ever more rapidly away as our lives become an experience in constant connected learning and personal and cultural growth. I want Hannah to take risks, to learn and grow from them whether the risks were successful or not. She will never be told no by me if she wants to try something and has a well-reasoned argument for doing it, provided it's not illegal or a risk to her health. My view is there is just one critical question that we should be asking our educators and the politicians responsible for education policy and programs. What are you actually doing now, tomorrow, next year that will ensure our children are equipped with the best connected tools, inspired and engaged by the diversity of their education, taught by the best possible teachers, and equipped with all the right skills to enter society as a valuable, contributing, collaborative member? For Hannah's sake, for the future of the type of education I believe she needs to thrive, I'm not interested in policy exploration, in white papers, in committees and the like. I'm interested in positive, measurable action. Imagine. Thank you.
Are there any questions of Stephen for his talk? I'm sure there was a lot to think about there and some very strong challenges to our policy and decision makers. But from people who captured the vision of Hannah as she's growing up in a very different world, any questions?
Hi, I think you're preaching to the converted. I love what you said. I just want to know one thing is how do we start? Where do we start?
Risk-taking. I would say be prepared to take a risk. There's a really interesting presentation that my wife, she's ex-military, gave me when she was doing officer training. She was given a presentation by Colin Powell, former chief military officer in the US and former Secretary of State. The first slide on his presentation said, "Do first, beg forgiveness later." Take a risk. Jump in. But think a bit about it first. Yeah, be sure you're solving a real problem and then just try things.
Oh, hi, I've got a 14-year-old daughter and she loves being connected, and I'm concerned about it because she likes being connected so much that our relationship suffers, and I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions about that.
I'm no child psychologist. This is the way Hannah's moving more and more this way. So, I mean, I used Hannah because it's a nice story. It's about finding relevance in, I'm not a child psychologist. We've got to find relevance in the relationships. So, for example, this is a story I was telling earlier. I was at a friend's house on the weekend and their two boys, 17 and 15, were on separate computers in the house playing World of Warcraft with some of their friends. And I said to Lee, who's their stepmom, "You keep checking in on the boys, what's the matter?" And she said, "They're on the computer all the time." I said, "Yeah, but what are they doing?" She said, "They're playing World of Warcraft." I said, "No, but what are they doing?" What they were doing is they're building skills in collaboration. They're building skills in negotiation. They're building skills in leadership. And as parents, I think we need to recognise that the way our kids are engaging these days and the way young people at work are engaging these days, because these issues are as relevant in the world of work as they are in education, they're not the same as when we, and I include all of us, because I went through an education that until year eight didn't see a computer. They don't engage at work and they don't engage societally the same way that we were taught to. I'm a digital migrant. I'm not a digital native. We need to be prepared to understand that's the way that they collaborate. I've got friends who say, "Oh yeah, I have better conversations with my kids via email than I do face to face." Because they said, "What did you do at school today?" "Nothing." But they talk to them via, shoot them an email from work before they come home, and they get three or four pages of response. "Oh yeah, I did this and this and this, and we're going to do this on the weekend, blah, 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 blah." So it's about finding the threads. That's my completely uneducated in child psychology opinion.
I'm going to hand over to, I'm putting Michael Coughlin on the spot here, because he had been telling me about some interesting research he had heard about in relation to how text chat was being used in games with youth. So I'm a bit fuzzy on it, so I'm going to hand over to Michael.
Yeah, that Michael, that's good.
Gee, thanks, Robin. The person whose research Robin's referring to is a lady called Virginia Carrington, and she's from the University of South Australia, and for the last couple of years she's been looking at specifically the language that is used in virtual worlds, and not just Second Life, but a whole range of other virtual spaces that younger people are living in or spending their time in, and social networking tools. And she was looking specifically at the language, nothing else. So she, as a neutral observer, a neutral researcher, she came to the overwhelming conclusion that if you look at the function of the language that young people are using in these environments, what she sees is support, encouragement, mentoring, assisting, collaborating, leadership, all of these verbs that just describe what are clearly positive attributes. So Stephen said something about leaders of tomorrow may well be those who were schooled in online games, and a few of us must have been thinking, "Oh yeah, right." But the research from people like Virginia Carrington would back it up. There's a lot of very positive learning going on in those games. Whatever we think of it, looking in from the outside, there's very good things happening within and between people in those worlds.
I'm not going to argue. I'm not aware of Virginia's research, but yeah, that validates everything that I've seen and all the other research that I've read.
I'm Mark Stegman. I'm a teacher from TAFE, and I was really inspired by your speech for a while, and probably because when I came to TAFE, when I came into teaching, many of my colleagues here, we are very altruistic and idealistic, and many of us could have made that same speech about, you know, getting those kids and, you know, getting them to fulfil their potential. But the fact is that it's not long after you get into VET that you realise that a lot of our kids aren't gifted, and they're not, you know, they're not exceptional. And for a large majority of teachers, I think, that come into TAFE, into VET, you know, they've found their way through the trades and whatever. So I was a bit worried about the focus on the, you know, the elite and how the school system, you know, holds them back, and not what the school system or the VET system does for the also-rans, you know, the rest of us. And the other part of it was the online gaming. Well, first of all, I did have a bit of a dark thought when you mentioned Colin Powell, because I hope that's not what he thought when we went into Iraq.
You and I both.
And the other thing was that I have a 15-year-old boy who is obsessed with online gaming. He's got an Xbox 360, and he, at the moment, he's into Call of Duty 4. He hasn't discovered World of Warcraft. The other one is, I'll think of it in a minute, but the other really uplifting one is the one where they go around beating up prostitutes and steal and killing drug dealers. So, you know, like, although there are positive aspects to collaboration and that, I'm a bit worried about some of the values. Okay. Grand Theft Auto. Okay, so just to sum up, I'll make my little speech. I've been in digital media for 13, 14, 15 years. And, you know, my industry was one of the first to be affected by it. And there's a lot of, you know, I'm an enthusiast to a degree. And I was saying to some other people here that there are novices amongst us here. I suppose there's novices, there's sceptics, there's cynics, and there's enthusiasts, which tend to be followers like me, who think, yeah, this is the way it's going to take our society, our jobs, our kids. And then there's evangelists who I find inevitably have a vested interest. And if they're not selling me an idea, they're selling me a product. And it's not that I want to knock them or anything, but I want to keep the totality of the picture, to keep everything in perspective, and to keep everyone, the teachers and the kids, in the one society. And I worry about my boy, who was a good athlete, who spends 13 hours on a Sunday, will be on the Xbox from Friday night, from every night of the week, Friday night, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday, and will take 5 minutes out to go and hit a ball against the wall. And, you know, his main objective is to kill avatars and blow their heads off. And, you know, although he's working in a team, I'm not sure that the end result is the one that I want.
I'm not going to argue about whether he's choosing the right games to play. They are, and again, I'm no child psychologist and I'm no parenting advisor. But, you know, for example, with Hannah, the choices about what she makes and chooses to do online are choices that she makes in concert with us. We give her some advice about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And we also have very strict rules about, you know, probably harder to enforce with a 15-year-old boy than an 11-year-old girl. But, you know, we have rules about how many hours that she can spend online and what's appropriate usage and what's not. And, you know, what, you know, in terms of like joining social networks and exploring these things, what's cool and what's not. For example, a really simple rule that we have is that for a lot of the kid-focused social networks, that social networks focused at under 18-year-olds, they have the option that you must enter a parental email address as well as your own email address when you sign up. We have a rule that says if it's one of those, you can sign up. If it's not one of those, then you have to come to us and talk to us about it. You know, I can't solve parenting problems, but there's good research around that indicates, you know, playing online games and engaging in social networks does build so valuable social skills. Whether by choosing to play Grand Theft Auto, which is the game that you refer to, he's making a good choice about what game to play is another question that I don't have the answer to, and that you as a parent, I guess, have to make a decision about. I mean, and hey, if you say no, he'll route around you and you'll go over to mates and play it anyway. So, you know, I guess, you know, if he's playing that at your place, then you can talk to him about what is culturally acceptable as opposed to not culturally acceptable. You know, fantasy violence, potentially in World of Warcraft, less so. Playing Grand Theft Auto where you're beating up prostitutes, you know, if I had a 15-year-old boy, I wouldn't want him to play it either.
Can I support you? As an older parent of adult children who've been connected since they were two and engaged with games like that since they were two, I would say the answer is talk. And I continually talk to them not about not playing stuff, but about the consequences, about values, attitudes, life skills, you know, what was really happening, what they thought about it, what they thought the consequences of it were. So I guess that's my advice.
We are busy. Sorry?
Is this on? Yeah, I think one of the things that we need to sort of focus on is the fact that these virtual worlds and the real life of these people we're educating are the same. We've got a separation between both of those, and in some cases, that nexus, we don't really realise that the social milieu they live in is both real and there. And in fact, that as teachers, as educators, as parents, that what we're in a position to do is influence both worlds of that they're in there. And it's up to us to, if we see people playing these things or we see people doing that, then that's saying something about the values that they're getting and the values that we need to sort of work on or associate. I too have had a son who's played World of Warcraft and the
Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, that's one, yep. So he sort of went through that stage, and yeah, that's important I think for them to explore that, because that's what their kids are doing. But the values they bring into those do things. My daughter, for example, the way I found out about blogs was my daughter was told that at school she shouldn't have this blog. And they threatened that they would sort of take things on because she had a photo on there from the school. It turned out she didn't actually take the photo. It was a girl who was in a class which she wouldn't be in. And the threat was they'll take her out of computer classes, which was quite all right, except that she wasn't doing any computer classes. It was all stuff she was doing at home. She wasn't getting engaged to that with that social sort of network. Again, another example from my daughter. I found that she was interested in wrestling. She was getting onto this wrestling site and she was doing things with this wrestling. I thought, hey, that's not the right thing for a young girl. Then I found out that what she was doing on the wrestling was in fact writing role plays or scripts. She was in fact doing screenplays and learning those skills there. So I think it depends on not the context in which they're doing it, but what they're actually doing in. And we need to look closely at that and find out where it is. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
A bit confused.
We need, in all the teaching that we do, it needs to be contextualised. We need to understand. Yeah, and also, the world is, as you say, there's no difference between online and offline now. It's just the world as it is. And I think it's incumbent upon us to understand as much as we possibly can about real life and online life and integrate the two. We don't have a choice. It's happening, it's here, and we just need to know.
Oh, hi. My name's Anna. I just wanted to pick up from what Robin was saying before about talking to kids and teenagers. I think you get to a point where you can't tell them what to do, but you can plant ideas or a seed or some sort of idea, and that works. And I've found that both as being a mother and also being a teacher. And I also think also role modelling ideas. And I've often found with teenagers too, when your back's turned, they'll do things in a particular way that they don't necessarily do when you're with you. And we were just saying that we like the idea of, you know, some of the European traditions of sitting around a table, things like that, that balance the life between computers and face-to-face. Same with teaching too. I do a blended versions of face-to-face and online. Thanks.
I'm walking across the room. There's a question over here. While I'm walking, I'm just going to say I actually studied gifted education, and gifted doesn't equal high IQs. We've got gifted carpenters and hairdressers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everything else in
there. Yeah, my sister's one of the best hairdressers I know, and she doesn't use a computer at all, but she's a gifted hairdresser.
So I'm just wondering now then how you're going to relate your story and your talk to what you've seen here, because I know you've been here for the 2 days.
One of the things that I have noticed, and I commented on Twitter this morning, it's going to be a couple of hours back in the stream, was that it's actually been a little bit of an epiphany for someone like me who lives very much on the technical edge to be here and see that what I take for granted is actually not, in terms of skill sets, something that a lot of you have got even got the remotest grip on. And that's nobody's fault. It's a matter of time. It's a matter of resourcing. It's a matter of money. It's a matter of priority. And not necessarily your priority, but, you know, your employer's priorities. But, you know, the world has moved this way, and we have a responsibility to understand as much of it as we possibly can. And it's people like me who, whether you pay me to come to your organisation or whether I just help you by mentoring you online, which I do a lot of, and I do a lot of it for nothing, is something that you can build skills in, because, you know, you can either, you know, take a deliberate effort to learn it in your workplace, or you can, you know, there's lots of people around like me who want to help. So, you know, if you do have skills that you need to learn, we're happy to help you learn them.
Hi, Stephen. Alex Hayes, to your left.
Hey, Alex.
thank you very much for a very engaging presentation. As we all know, we can evangelise or be seen to be issuing mantras which could challenge and could be thought-provoking and raise some key questions, and I think you've done that very successfully.
Thank you.
In fact, to my left, Michael Coughlin online through Twitter is asking a key pertinent question. Should anyone play Grand Theft Auto? And if they should, or if they could, or if they will, what does it mean in terms of, as you said, about the connectedness, the nature of network learning and the nature of what it means now for us as educators as we move forward using this technology? Thanks again for a very thought-provoking and engaging presentation.
Thanks, Alex.
Stephen, thank you for that. It's, I have to say that you can see from my hair that I'm not a youngster. And what I can say to you, and that is that I really do agree with some parts of what you said and disagree with others. But what I will say is that I was told as a young fella not to engage in playing snooker and not to engage in playing pinball machines. One could make the argument that it's good for hand-eye coordination, but I'm fine on hand-eye coordination. I don't need it. I didn't need to play those games. And it was the boundaries that were set by my parents that defined it. And that's what it comes to with Grand Theft Auto. It's not appropriate for young adults. And that's the way it is. And those are the same boundaries that you need to set.
I would agree with you completely. I mean, you know, as educators, you know, all of us in here are mentoring somebody in some way, whether it's a child, whether it's a student. And as the lady over here said, it's about instilling some values in them as part of what you do. And, you know, I wouldn't want my kids to play Grand Theft Auto, but I'm not going to stop anyone if they want to. I mean, hey, it's rated MA-15, which means, hey, if you've got a kid who's under 15, don't let them play Grand Theft Auto. They probably haven't got the intellectual and emotional maturity to play it.
Yeah, I agree with
Grand
that.
Theft Auto is an interesting case.
Just one other point there. I wouldn't like people to take away, though, from the message you put forward that classroom-based learning perhaps is not the future, because I can tell you from many years of experience that having an inspiring teacher in a classroom is the best way of learning and the best way of being motivated. And yes, by all means, get out and let them collaborate, let them get online with all their other tools, but we mustn't put those particular tools into the rubbish bin and say they're no good anymore. They are.
No. And in fact, the best teachers that I had in classes were the ones that inspired me and not that taught me lots of things. Anyone can learn things. Not everyone can learn inspiration.
Hi, my name's Jenny. I'm from TAFE. I enjoyed your talk. It reminds me of a book by Neil Postman from 1972 called Teaching as a Subversive Activity, which I very much enjoyed when I was studying. It's about encouraging children to think for themselves, you know, developing the skills within children so that they're able to think for themselves. However, I also do think that children are able to be manipulated, and there are, you know, very sophisticated forces out there that do manipulate children.
Absolutely.
And I think what Mark was speaking about was addiction, and I think children do need help with that. It's not just about developing skills, but there are children do become addicted to things that aren't good for them, and I think that they do need professional help with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would not disagree with you.
Thanks, Robin. And as Robin's just indicated to me, that's our final question if we're going to get you home on time. And just before we close, I'd like to thank Stephen Collins for his presentation and some old-fashioned hospitality lubricant. That's something you can't do online. So thank you. Don't go away.